to the practical application of this work. And today, in a little while, we're going to be talking about it in groups. And so this is a setup for the group that we're going to go back to our small group. This is getting us ready for that, just sort of helping us to frame what we're going to be talking about together. And you may or may not have read the article that Allison and I passed out that explains in more detail what this methodology might look like. So this morning we're going to talk about it as a general theory of practice. This afternoon we're going to have an opportunity to actually do it. Okay, so two pieces. We're building together using David's insights, poetic insight. We're building a Dharma teaching. Let's just use that phrase and borrow it from the Buddhist world, meaning a wisdom teaching for our work, our monastic vocation as a community who come together every once in a while, but then we immediately go back into the monastery of the world. And we're a community that recognizes that we have that rhythm, and then we're recognizing what it is that we're actually doing in the world. We're not just being religious. We have a saging opportunity. We're following the template as students of Yeshua. So we are trying in the best way that we can to embody his template, which is not easy to do, obviously. First of all, we're removed by 2,000 years. We're in a different place, a different culture. And we have to imagine what that template might be like, just the way Buddhists have to imagine what it means to follow the template of the Buddha. So we have two templates that we can easily imagine. One is the templement of enlightenment, and the other is the template of anointing. And what that template gives us is this image that's on the screen. That Yeshua, as a template of enlightenment or of anointing, is embodying Logos Sophia, the masculine and the feminine vision of this energy in the universe that creates the world and creates us. The Logos is the order and the beautiful symmetry of things. Sophia is the beauty and the eloquence. And Yeshua walks this template. He embodies it. He walks in beauty. And he gives voice to a reality like the Buddha gave voice to a reality from beyond this world. He is not just mimicking flatland. He is a theophany. He is an embodiment, an eternal embodiment, just as others have embodied in an eternal way this transcendence that has birthed us. So he images, he visualizes, he's a visionary, and he verbalizes in a prophetic way this other reality, and we, his students, follow in that tradition. So using his template, we awaken, we stand up out of the matrix of flatland. We ourselves are united. And we become biaxial beings. So let me put that on the board, because that was what we were struggling with. And this is David's hermetic consciousness. So as followers of his template, we become biaxial, meaning we actually live along two axes. We live inside of space-time, and we embody that world. And we also stand up into another axis and reality of transcendence, and we seek to embody that world. And here's the trick. We have two centers in our own being that register those two axes. So we have two, as Cynthia would say, two operating systems at work inside of us. And it's hard to coordinate those. They can be non-coordinated, in which case we become incoherent. Or, by practice, we can learn to coordinate them, in which case there is coherence. By definition, that's eloquent and beautiful. Yeshua worked with these two axes, lived them, and they were beautifully coordinated inside of him. He is not the only one that has ever done that. He is simply a template as to how to do that, how to be coherent. So just to be really absolutely clear, we have an operating system that's pretty much centered in our heads. I don't think that's totally right, but it's pretty much, we kind of, when we think, we have thoughts, and it's in an operating system called the mind, and we are aware of that mental process, and it's a very powerful tool, and in it is language and lots of other things, reason and insight in an analytical way. We use that, and we've been trained to use it, and it's a powerful tool, and thank God for it. And then we have, according to the wisdom tradition, another operating system that is centered in another part of our being, and it's the cardial operating system, and it's very different from the mental operating system. It's intuitive, it is analogical, it's imaginal, it's artistic, it's so many things. And when inside of one being, the analytical and the imaginal work together, it's a beautiful thing. So maybe that's what Patty Ann Rogers was doing in that poem. She was both in her head and in her heart. And we could see both sides of it, and the poem turns out to be a beautiful poem, right? So I want to introduce two words, and they're in the text that we passed out, to say that in the two operating systems, the mental and the cardial, that have to be coordinated. And guess what? Nobody can make us do it, and we have no sort of switch that coordinates them. It's an actual practice inside of us. When those are coordinated inside of us as biaxial creatures, those two operating systems are working together, something alchemical, hermetic, magical happens. And this morning in chapel, we chanted both of them. It's so amazing. Because we chanted this chant, "When I awaken, I will see your face, my God, and I will gaze upon your image and be satisfied." That is the heart's capacity to gaze upon an icon and see something. It's called akasia, from the word icon. The word of icon in Greek is this, and we translate it this way in English, but that's the Greek word, and the capacity of our cardial operating system to gaze upon an icon and be satisfied by it is called akasia. Yes.
And then quick question, from a Gurdjieffian standpoint, are you combining the intuitive gut operating system with the cardial?
I am, and probably I would need to sort of slow down and think about how the Gurdjieffian system uses that. You have three centers in the Gurdjieffian center, the emotional center, the moving center, and the cardial center. Am I using them right? I can't remember. But I would say, just generally speaking, let's just say yes, and then maybe we'll have to write a footnote and say, well, we differ in these respects. This is sort of coming not from the Gurdjieff, it's coming from an older system. It's coming from Jewish mystical tradition, it's coming from the early Jesus tradition, it's coming from Sufi tradition, and then that gets loaded into maybe the Gurdjieff system later. Yes?
I would say that the process of ordination is very much the physicality as well as mental.
Good. That's why I said I'm not too happy with just centering it only here, because it's physical. And embodiment says it's got to be everything. So the coordination has to be somatic, psychic, psychikos, soulish, and pneumikos, pneumatic, noetic, cardial. I mean, and now we're just expanding all the capacities of the embodiment tradition. This is incarnation. This is what incarnation means.
I was going to say, I mean, I think, just to go real quick, the Gurdjieff system, I think he would say the cardial is the higher emotional and higher intellectual centers, and the mental is more of these three kind of functional centers that are primarily situated on the horizontal realm.
Okay, good.
Realm.
I think
up and running,
yeah,
then we're entering into more higher emotional, intellectual
so
capabilities.
So we have in the modern world these wonderful, I would say, attempts to synthesize. And Gurdjieff is one, and the Diamond Approach is another, and Ken Wilber is seeking to do it, and there's many, many individuals and groups at work seeking to give a coherent view of what is so interesting about being human as we live on the planet. Okay, Vikasya is one power that the cardial operating system is able to download from a higher dimension into space-time. It is the way we download. And then the other one, and I keying off again, a Greek word which is old, and it's akousia. Akousia is based on the word akupo, means to listen.
We can't see it.
I know. And I'm going to move that. I've been a little reluctant to move this, but I'm going to do it for the moment. Okay, so we chanted, listen, listen, wait in silence, listening for the one from whom all mercy flows, right? We chanted that. So we chanted, I shall gaze upon your image and be satisfied. What, physical eye? No. Listening, outer ear? No. We were talking about this cardial perception. We were chanting about that inner seeing and inner hearing. We download, like Yeshua does, into this world through ikasia and akousia. Okay. Deep seeing, deep listening. Or another way of saying it is, we practice in our Christian world lectio divina and visio divina. Meaning a kind of divine hearing of the text. Not literalistic, and a divine seeing of the image. Again, we're penetrating the surface of any image into its depth. In which case, it becomes a vehicle for download. And that download is what we would call wisdom's voice, and it appears to us epiphany, but in truth it is theophany. So I'm keying off of David's two words. Don't worry so much if you don't know those right away, but it's okay because you're the site in which all of that appears and is transmitted. So to become a transmitter, you have to be a site in which something is being received. You can't transmit what you do not have. Neither can I. I can do it by tradition, by hearsay. my teacher said, or I can do it by virtue of having actually received it and embodied it and lived it and coordinated it and made it practical. So I am most effective in saging when I have done the embodiment integrative work, and then that flows out, but I have to have had a source of receptivity, and I have to be a site where it can be received. So, quickly speaking, that's the Dharma teaching. We are attempting to explain all of that complexity. Two axes, two operating systems, different kinds of coordinations, a faculty for seeing, a faculty for hearing, the putting them together in an integrative way, in a wise way, by virtue of our own practice. That's all Dharma teaching. That's what we do. And if we do that, then we can become sites in this world that desperately needs it. If we can't do that, we're not as effective. Or maybe not effective at all. So, what we would like to do in preparation for the discussion...
Lynn?
Yes.
Actually, a duh.
Yeah, say a duh.
So, and I'm just speaking out loud, okay? So, if there's divine hearing,
mm-hmm. Akusiya,
and divine seeing,
Ekasiya,
then there would be divine feeling and divine speaking.
There would be, okay.
Could I experience, what I'm saying, is there, if I am hearing and seeing.
Then that is divine speaking.
Then I can feel it divinely, and then I can express it, not maybe verbally, but express it.
Okay, so you're saying, then comes integration. Then comes integration. I have to bring it down into my experience, to feel it inside of my experience, to embody it inside of my experience, to practice it inside of my experience, and then as it happens, to express it. When the time comes and the moment arrives, and then it's there and it can be expressed. But it has to have been coordinated inside of you. I mean, you have to receive through akusiya and ekasiya, we use those terms, deep listening, deep seeing. Then you integrate through your own affective work with it, and then it becomes part of your being, and then it can be expressed. So that's alchemical. That's the alchemy of this. And that's why we've used that term also. And that's hermetic consciousness. That right there is hermetic consciousness. You're uniting many things into one. They're not flying apart. They're not put in two different systems. They're not disparate from one another. You are the site of integration. You're the site.
Lynn, so what's the difference between, what would you say the difference is between hermetic consciousness and theophany?
Well, theophany is the divine actually appearing, showing up, and manifesting inside of you. So when Logos Sophia shows up at Jesus' baptism, that's theophany. And then it was something he didn't project, he was receiving. This was not just a psychic projection of his own needs, and you know, this was something very, very beyond his own self. So, and that is the divine in its eternal sense, being giving itself to us and saying, here I am. I am here, and I'm showing up, and I'm available, and then I receive, and then I integrate, and then I can express. Something like that.
I still don't get it.
Well, getting it intellectually is one thing, and I'm not sure. The problem is probably me not expressing it clearly enough. And then the other part is then I have to live it. So we can have maybe that might be part of our discussion when we break into small groups. So let's hold that as a group discussion thing. Okay? That'd be good. That'd be very cool to discuss. And that doesn't mean we're going to come to a complete understanding, because we're throwing out terms that we, you know, that we're maybe doing it too quickly, but at any rate, they're out there and they're great. They're great ideas. Now, before we go to our discussion, Allison and I want to just quickly step through the marriage of text and image and give you examples so that you can practice just very quickly acacia and acousia. The traditional flow has already presented itself to us, has downloaded itself into time and space, and it has usually come in the form of a text, and sometimes we hear the text only intellectually and do not see the image of it. So, listen to the first one. And this one, you know, it's the first pop out of the imaginal box. It's called Psalm 1.
Blessed, oh blessed, I say, are those who walk upon a path whose steps are firmly planted on your eternal law. For in that word they find their joy, their meditation day and night, and do not wander far to take the counsels of the worldly wise. These wise of word speak guile. Their scorn of you is made from prideful seats above the masses far below. But the blessed ones grow strong as living trees, their roots sink deep, and hidden beside the flowing streams which come from you. And through life's passing seasons, they do not cease to bear a plenitude of fruit, nor do they fade from giving shade of leaf that covers all with good. While on the other path, there is no shade or water near, and all life withers quickly in the winds and blows across the grass. So when the sad results of wickedness give witness to their lives, they fall away and have no place in your eternal circle of the wise. You guard and guide the path that leads to life, and those who walk in rightful relationship to all. But those who choose the other path, their steps lead surely into doom.
Okay, two images. We've heard that psalm over and over again. The question would be, how have you imaged that? Have you ever imaged it? You've heard the words of it. How have you imaged it? So we have just quickly, this is a very simple early path discussion. It's a dualistic system, and it says there are two paths in the universe and walking across the world. One is a path to the good, and one is a path or to beauty and life, and another path is to doom and death. Simple, easy for everybody to get. Choose. So, first pop out of the box is that. And it's, we wanted to put an image with it so that we could both hear the text and see an icon of these possibilities. We're not going to comment anymore. We just wanted you to see them. Two images that might, in fact, evoke in you and in others a way of envisioning and hearing the text. Okay? All right. The next one, we're going real fast now, is in Thomas. It's Logian 11. It's highly complex. Read the text, and then I'll start showing the images.
Yeshua says, the sky and all that lives in the dimensions above it will cease to exist. The dead know nothing of life, and the living will never die. When you consume that which is already dead, you are turning it back into life. So then, when you too re-emerge into the light, what will you do? For on the day when you were created one, you also became two. But when you come to realize your trueness again, what will you do?
Okay. That text is almost impenetrable as an intellectual exercise because it's four images layered on top of one another. And the question is, how do you read them from the top down or the bottom up? If you read the commentary, you realize, oh, you have to start at the bottom and go up. There's a little clue in the Logian 10 ahead of it that says, I send fire into the cosmos. I'm going to fan it until it blazes. And when it starts to blaze, it starts at the bottom. The bottom is you begin to realize your two-ness again. And then you realize this world eats its dead and it's living. And then there's a question of who's alive and who's dead. And when you emerge from this, what will you do? Okay, now, maybe not perfect images, but at least it begins to suggest that there's a wisdom in this text that just Jesus spoke that I need to attend to. And maybe there's a way of seeing it that I might not see otherwise. So by marrying the text with an image, by being able to listen deeply to the text and see through these images, I may begin to receive its download. So that's what we're demonstrating. Okay. Flying fast, we're going to go to Logian 88. 88 is one of our favorites, and maybe yours.
Yeshua says, the angels and the prophets will come and bring you what already belongs to you, and will give to them what you have to... The angels and the prophets will come and bring you what already belongs to you, and you will give to them what you have to give. But ask yourself this, when may they come and receive back from you what already belongs to them?
Okay, now we're going really fast, and this needs a day or two. Okay. But this says something really amazing about you on the earth and your role. The angels and the prophets will come and bring to you what they have to bring. They will bring their gift. And the question is, from that realm, they come down and they bring you, and we use this very tender bringing, embrace, bringing. What, and they're asking, what do you have to give? I don't know. What?
Reminds me of the pearl.
Good.
The hymn of the pearl.
Perfect. Exactly. You should make that connection. Wonder if, in each case, what we have to give is this image. Back to that. From that comes this, cycles back, and what we give is that. The prophets bring their voice, their seeing. We do with it what we do with prophetic, poetic. We analyze it, we parse it out, we make things with it, but out of it emerges, and this is a Sufi image, something that flies back to its source. And you have nailed it. Meaning, we have to give back from our experience something vital to the angels, to the prophets. But we have to receive. So this text, listening to it, you go, I'm so confused by that text. might the image suggest possibilities? So we tried to build into the images possibilities that would give a seer and a listener through akasya and akusya, they would be able to begin to detect what is happening. Okay, one more. I know this is fast. No, it's not quite fair, but it's fun. Okay, this is from Philip. We're bypassing, we did Psalms, we all know Psalms, easy image, not a difficult one. We did something from Thomas 11, difficult image. 88, even maybe more difficult. And now we're going to analog 3, which is a very simple beginning, but very complex in its cosmology in the Gospel of Philip. So let's hear it, and you will see it again.
Those who sow in winter reap in the summer. Winter symbolizes the world system, the cosmos, and summer, the great age, the ion, the realm of transcendence. Let us sow, therefore, in this world that we may reap in some time. For this reason, we are not asked to pray for harvest in winter time, but for the summer which comes from winter. If one tries to reap in the winter time, it only uproots the field, and there is no harvest. This approach is fruitless since nothing emerges in the winter, and as a result, in that other realm, the true Sabbath, the field becomes barren.
Image and text. Image and text.
It is absolutely true that if you use the text, it's possible to generate discussion, right? If we sat here with the text, analog 3, and just attempted to analyze it, it would produce something. But by hearing it as a wisdom text and seeing it iconically, maybe something else can be generated. Maybe a deeper hearing and a deeper seeing. A lectio divina and a visio divina.
Do we often, we've experienced more that we see the world in a certain sense, the cosmos where we live, but when our deeper meaning begins to gel is when we say, what does that mean to me personally?
Absolutely.
In my relationship
Absolutely.
To the world or one another. So. We see the world one way, and then we say, how can we be in the world?
Absolutely. And so what these do is it forces, it gives you an opportunity to go deeper than your analytical mind, to use your cardial operating system. So what we're trying to do as in our saging work is to bring people into that part and then to coordinate them. Because we don't want them to throw away their analytical, their exegetical. We're not saying your historical critical is of no importance. But when these texts were written, in what era, and by whom, at what time of the day, and which community, and how the community received it, and all the historical context is very interesting. But it's where it hits you. And how do you bring that coordination as wisdom practitioners helping to bring this into the modern world?
Could I say something about the question that was raised about the difference between theophany and hermeneutics? So I think I experienced it. So these, I would sort of get up and then read the text, and then there'd be something that would happen, and the image would appear, and it would land, and I would look at it, and I would go, well, that's interesting. And what would happen then is, if you like, a mental question would come. And the question would be like, well, how does this relate to the temple mysticism that we've been talking about? And that might be a context that we had before. And there'd be this sort of open question. And sometimes it would be, I would send the open question to Lynn, and then there'd be, and I'd get a response, or sometimes the aha would come internally. That, I think, is the hermeneutic understanding, right?
The aha.
The aha. So it brings in the mental piece, the question, that is rising out of the theophany, the experience of the download of the image, right? And then there's a question, and then there's maybe an answer to the question, and then there's an aha which opens up, oh, I see now.
So it's like a little bit of a journey up the mountain, you have the hike, and then you get to the overlook.
Yes, exactly. And you see something more than just what the image was. And you see the implications of it in a way that you hadn't understood before. And if you just landed with the experience of the image and you didn't ask the question, I wouldn't have known how to proceed. Does that make sense?
I kind of think of Jesus had his epiphany at the baptism, but then he had to work with it and struggle with it, which is the wilderness time after that, before he could actually, how is he going to transmit this and embody this, which then went into his ministry. So it's how do you integrate it inside of yourself and play with it and then embody it.
That's good. Because it's a huge discussion of practice. And what happens to us, the way Allison is talking about, was a living embodiment of dealing with a text, and then it beginning to be a living thing and not just a dead piece of paper. A living transmission, a wisdom transmission that is able to enliven us. So if you heard Analog 3, it might be interesting. If I showed you this image without Analog 3, it might be interesting. You might say, what is that? Clearly there's a winter motif, but I don't know what in the world that is at the top. That doesn't fit with my idea. And I don't know what that sprout's doing at the bottom. So how could winter and a sprout and this globe up at the top, how could that be anything but just a pretty picture, or a kind of new age, whatever. But when you hear it married to the text, okay, this is a transmission across the ages about a Dharma teaching that was encoded for our benefit. So how to receive it, how to work with it, and so forth is the question. And as practitioners of this tradition, how do we do that? How can we do that and be effective? So, let's go now to our small groups and have you have the questions that are going to be on the table, and we'll hear what you say and how you've processed. Yes, Gary.
Since Anne is not here, do we need to redistribute?
Oh, that's a good...
We have a new person.
And we have a new some new people.
She's not in a group. She can be Anne.
That's okay.
We have some chainsawing in the woods, Debbie, yeah, that we'd rather you do.
But it was. There's purpose. I could just take her spot.
Yeah, you just take... Just join a group. Doesn't matter. So, Anne's group was...